Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching and reading and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we've got joy, we've got anger, we've got fear, and we've got all the other feelings in Pixar's latest creation, Inside Out. We'll talk about voices, jokes, visuals, and whether the time has come for sadness to get an Oscar. And from the innocence of children to the lack of innocence of parents, we'll talk about the romantic lives of moms and dads and whether pop culture can let those things coexist. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? Well, he kind of does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
It's a big week for big emotions, but before we get to that, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our pal Kat Chow. Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a blogger for NPR's Code Switch team.
Well, welcome to everybody. It's good to see all of you. Inside Out is Pixar's 15th movie in its 20-year history. It takes place inside the mind of an 11-year-old girl named Riley, whose family has just moved from Minnesota, yay, to San Francisco,
Minnesota.
The main characters are Riley's emotions, who are cartoony little beings who are literally in charge of running her mind from a central console. Joy is voiced by Amy Poehler. Sadness by Phyllis Smith, who you might know as Phyllis from The Office. Fear by Bill Hader. Anger by Lewis Black. And disgust by a very disgusted Mindy Kaling. And as you know, if you listen to a lot of Pop Culture Happy Hour, we have been looking forward to this movie for a while. Stephen first talked about it almost a year ago when the first looks were emerging, so I want to go to Stephen first. Stephen, you had extremely high expectations for this movie. How did it go for you?
I had almost impossibly high expectations for this movie. I allowed my hopes to soar beyond the heavens, and I just was not disappointed at all. I absolutely loved this movie. This movie was, it's so much in my wheelhouse. It's from, among others, Pete Docter, who directed Up, which is my favorite Pixar movie. This is right there with it for me. I just absolutely adored this film. There's a point in this movie where Joy and Sadness are sent hurtling off to embark upon a quest, and it feels very Pixar familiar. They're going to go on a big journey, and you start to see, like, okay, I know the beats of this movie. And then every step of the way, there are surprises. There's this incredible visual imagination to this movie. They're journeying through different parts of this girl's brain. And along with it, they're going in a bunch of different directions in terms of the visual approach to the film. And it's an incredibly heartfelt film. It is beautiful.
I was at the screening with you and your kids, and I was hearing your 11-year-old girl laughing from the intro. Which I was, and I had been warning you that she was maybe going to hold out on you because she's like that. But she did not seem to be.
Yeah. I mean, I'm the one who just spluttered through this whole movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
me
I cried almost the entire time. Like,
I cried a fair amount during this movie. How about you, Glenn? How did this go for you?
Well, let's stipulate that this movie, this specific movie, is going to land on a me, say, differently than it would land on, say, a Stephen Thompson,
right,
for example.
True, for a bunch of reasons.
For a bunch
of reasons. Some experiential and some personality.
Absolutely.
And stuff like that.
That's it. I like this film. I enjoyed this film. I will recommend this film. Is it my favorite Pixar film? Nope. If you hear that this film is all about the feelings of an 11-year-old girl and you're me, you kind of go, hey. But this film is, I would argue, even to a greater degree, about memory. And memories, plural. And it is very smart in something we've talked about on the show many times, which is how strong emotions color and, in many ways, kind of fix memory in the long term. And as we were learning more about the world of this film and we were getting more and more details about how long-term memory works and we were starting to get more detail about the islands of personality which come into this, I started to get worried like I was worried and ultimately disappointed in Wreck-It Ralph. I liked it less than y'all did because I thought it was just overloading it with all this infrastructure, all these things we needed to keep in mind to understand what the stakes were. Ultimately, it totally blew through that because, again, this film, unlike, I think, Wreck-It Ralph, trusted the story to do what it needed to do and set the stakes and make me care. There's a character played by the great Richard Kind.
Oh, there is.
He's so great.
And if anybody but the great Richard Kind played that role, it would swiftly kind of go over into cloying and saccharine sweet, but he keeps it on the right level.
He is great in this movie.
A lot of great jokes that really land, including one that doesn't. There's a back and forth between the mom and the dad at the dinner table.
Okay, yep. I wanted to talk about this
scene.
Yeah,
I want to talk about this too.
Which is in the trailer, and it's basically the dad is not paying attention because he's thinking about sports and the mom is trying to get his attention. That edged into a very defending the caveman place, into a very Tool Time with Tim Taylor
it's
place.
It's very much that.
And it just didn't feel like it belongs in this movie.
It doesn't.
It was saved. And you know what saved it? The dad's eyes jitter worriedly. Not that they do, but how they do. The animation here is unsurprisingly spot on. So I liked it.
So Kat, what did you think of this movie?
I loved this movie. I mean, I was once an 11-year-old girl and I felt many, many things and I still do. And I kind of wonder what all the emotions in my brain right now are trying to do. One thing that I kept thinking about as I was watching this was how a younger audience really took it in, because there were so many moral messages, I mean, about emotional maturity, like Glenn was saying, then also about how memory can really color something. And what I loved about this movie was as we are journeying through the sort of different layers of Riley's mind, we learned so much more about her life. And there were just some very, very sweet emotional moments, like when she met Bing Bong, the imaginary character. Mm-hmm. And I think that just brought me to a place where I thought how nice and also how sad it is to grow up. And that's really just what struck me.
I think that like a lot of Pixar movies, what made this movie so great to me is its respect for melancholy and fear as part of the lives of kids. And as you watch this movie, one of the things that you learn is that joy, right? Amy Poehler, joy appears to be the central and most important character. And one of the things that develops over the course of the movie is the limitations of joy as a perfect solution to everything. To me, being able to nail the fact that one of the pressures that 11-year-old girls feel, and maybe 11-year-old boys too, I can't speak to that, but one of the pressures that 11-year-old girls feel is a pressure to be happy all the time. Mm-hmm. That is extremely sophisticated as an idea for a movie. That, to me, I looked at that and I thought, I don't know that I've ever seen a movie, particularly a movie pitched at kids, that I think is as respectful of the fact that being sad is not dysfunctional. Being sad is not something wrong. Being sad is something that happens in life. When, for example, you have to leave one place and go to another place, or when you experience change, or for kids who go through divorces, or kids who go through having to change schools, or kids who go through the loss of someone, that it is not your job as a kid to be happy all the time. And I think that is an extraordinarily sophisticated message. And I kept thinking about this movie and trying to figure out what is it structurally about this movie that feels so unusual to me. And I couldn't put my finger on it. And then I remembered there's no bad guy. I think it's extremely wise that there's no symbol of that struggle. Yeah. There's not like insecurity as a big giant like gray monster stomping around. And it's,
that's the only thing that isn't realistic is that in my head is a gigantic ball of nuts, like just stomping around going, you're bad.
But I think that would be partly from sadness and partly from fear. And it's like, but I think they're very wise not to specify a single destructive emotion that's causing all the trouble. That what's causing all the trouble for her is the conflict between all these perfectly healthy feelings and trying to balance all these perfectly healthy feelings. And I think, like Kat, I watched it thinking, boy, and you could hear the kids in the theater just laughing and giggling at various different things. But I think there's a lot here that you have to be pretty sophisticated to understand what they're saying. When you see an 11-year-old girl who has been robbed of everything except anger, fear, and disgust, and how she behaves, you think, that's really smart. That is somebody who has been around kids that age and knows how tough it can be for them.
There is a wonderful way that those emotions manifest in her. One of the mistakes this movie could have made is to have anger at the controls, you know, crank down on the lever and have the response be volcanic. But the response is often a flash of the eyes. Mm-hmm. The little anger character voiced by Lewis Black is volcanic and the flames shoot out of the head and it's very cute and funny, but it's subtle and sophisticated in the way anger colors the way she behaves.
Right. I think they're very smart not to have it be. She's not governed by one of these emotions at a time.
Right.
Right. She sort of is, but they're all kind of in there and they're all pulling in different directions at different times.
Yeah. And I think also what I really loved was seeing the different emotions try to emulate one another. So there's a point in the movie where happy and sadness go off, and disgust, anger, and fear are left to their own devices to kind of run Riley. And there are a bunch of different scenes where they're all tasked with the idea of trying to be happy, because no one wants to be sad. So of course, the default is happiness for them, because that's just how Riley is. And seeing, like, disgust, Mindy Kaling, try to be happy was a real treat.
Joy would know what to do.
That's it. Until she gets back, we just do what Joy would do.
Great idea. Anger, fear, disgust. How are we supposed to be happy?
Hey, Riley, I've got good news. I found a junior hockey league right here in San Francisco. And get this, tryouts are tomorrow after school. What luck, right?
Uh-oh, what do we do?
Guys, here, you pretend to be Joy.
Won't it be great to be back out on the ice?
Oh, yeah, that sounds fantastic.
What was that? That wasn't anything like Joy!
Because I'm not Joy?
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, it's so human where, I mean, we've all had so many instances where we've had to, you know, put on a happy face when really we just want to say, no, that's awful.
Yeah, the only thing that I didn't quite necessarily get the schema was the disgust character, which I think functions in the film and in Riley more like disdain. And it was really fun to see when we jump into other people's heads, as we do occasionally in this film, how the hierarchy is slightly different in everybody's heads, how some people have disdain front and center, high, and other people have different things. And it also leads indirectly, and this is a slight spoiler, to maybe the best cat joke that has ever been.
Man. Yeah, I think that's true. And that takes me into something else I wanted to mention, which is, I am so moved by this movie. I'm so impressed by its sophistication. I'm so impressed by its thoughtfulness. But this is also a really funny, funny movie that I laughed at a lot, that I laughed at a lot of its little jokes. It has a couple of runners that kind of keep popping up in different places,
man,
that really made me laugh that I don't want to spoil. This is a movie that the jokes are really effective. Phyllis Smith as Sadness is so funny to me.
So good.
She, if you know the story of kind of how she became Phyllis on The Office, she was working in casting, and she was doing, as I understand it, a lot of readings with people who were reading for roles, and they eventually just said, well, it should be you. And kind of became a known actress through that role because they were smart enough to spot her. And in this movie, she is so wonderful, I think, and that she's so funny and the jokes are so good. But she also, that character of Sadness is so critical to this movie and so much a part of where this movie is going.
Well, and you root for her. Like, you root for somebody who is ostensibly, especially early on in the film, is kind of cast as the problem.
Right.
And the fact that this movie doesn't treat Sadness as the problem is so smart. Among the touches that I love in this movie, Linda, you and I think will both appreciate the fact that this is a movie about how the girl wants to go to the Midwest. She's taken away from the Midwest, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
instead of worrying that she's going to have to get sent back to the Midwest.
Yeah.
As a Midwesterner, I appreciated that she misses the Midwest.
Yeah. It's pretty fantastic. And I do want to go back just briefly, the scene that we talked about with the father and the mother. I had this same conversation with someone on Twitter when I talked just kind of obliquely on Twitter about the fact that I had really loved it. Someone said to me, like, oh, I'm glad to hear that it overcomes the sort of wretched, backward gender stereotypes of things of the trailer, which I can't disagree. That is a little
familiar.
In the context of the movie, it's so small that you understand that it's just a little joke.
Right.
But to have centered that in the trailers is really unfortunate. I think they did it because it's really hard to explain, as you said, Glenn, all the stuff that's going on in the movie. in the space that you have in a trailer, but centering that in the trailer is too bad because there are going to be people who are going to say, meh, not for me, because it's just going to be all this, men are like this, women are like this, which it's not really like that at all.
The dad's thoughts are like, he's not paying attention, he's a dullard, he's thinking about the game, which is funny, in the UK trailer, it's a soccer game.
Oh, really? That's funny.
And then the mom's central concern, instead of just simply having worry dominate the parents' thoughts in this scene, the mom, all she can think about is how disappointed she is in the dad, which is just such a simplistic, unpleasant viewing. Later in the film, when they're jumping in, and this, I'm not going to spoil anything, but when they're jumping into the heads of other characters, it's more nuanced. And I just kind of
wish... It's still funny, but it's more nuanced.
I also just wish, you know, a decision that I would have made is when they're looking through the eyes of older people to maybe have a larger cast of emotions governing what's going on. Where's lust?
Sure.
Where's greed? Where's sloth?
Sure. Sloth.
I want these little seven deadly sins puppets behind them.
I get that. I do want to say, in 2009, I wrote a post for the blog that was about how much I hoped that they would make a movie about a girl who is not a princess. And I was so deeply satisfied by this movie in that regard. I agree with people who say movies aren't political. You can't make people make certain things. That's very tricky. Representational questions, when you're addressing them to individual creators or creative collectives, essentially, are complicated because many people are more comfortable writing about certain things than other things. I totally get that. It was purely greedy on my part. I just wanted to see what they would do with a movie about a girl who wasn't a princess because I thought they would make something amazing. And I don't delude myself that they ever heard it or thought about it or were answering me with this movie. But if they had been, it would have been the best case scenario for the answer that I was looking for when I hoped that they would make that movie. And I'll link to that piece and you can kind of see how desperately I was begging for pretty much this movie. Yeah. So that was really wonderful for me as well. I'll be happy to hear what a lot of you think about the movie. I'm sure that a bunch of folks are going to go out and see it. I know a lot of people who follow me on Twitter are excited about it and looking forward to it. I can't wait to hear what you think. So come and find us on Facebook or on the blog or on Twitter at NPRPCHH and tell us what you think. When we come back, hot dads. Not really. Not really. Not really, but kind of. More about that after this.
Hi, I'm Josh, and I'm calling from Azusa, California. Fifth generation, maker of Tito's Handmade Vodka. Tito Beverage, yes, that's his real name, incorporates the concepts of artisan craftsmanship found in boutique wineries into the spirits industry to create Tito's Handmade Vodka. Tito still uses the time-honored pot still batch distillation process at the original distillery where he started it all, in Austin, Texas. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from corn and is naturally gluten-free.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. You know, as we put this show together, and this is a true story, we were thinking about what it would be a good time to cover, and we were going back and forth a little bit between Father's Day and hot weather. Father's Day, hot weather, Father's Day, hot weather. And I said, hot dads, which of course is not the topic. The topic is not hot dads, but it did get us talking about the fact that popular culture often has a really weird relationship with parents having healthy, active, romantic lives. So we thought we'd talk a little bit about that. Now, before we get started, I feel we should say we only have one parent on the panel. And if you listen to the show, you know that none of us tend toward romantic confessionals. So please don't be sad that we are not putting Stephen on the spot to discuss sexy parents. Instead, I'm going to put Glenn on the spot with a simple question. Am I wrong when I say that in my experience, culture often finds it very hard to reconcile parenthood and sexiness?
No, you're not wrong. It's changed. It's probably getting better. It's certainly changing. Rob and Laura Petrie in the old Dick Van Dyke Show famously slept in twin beds.
Right.
Then the Bradys, just a few years later, had a queen-size bed, actually. And they slept in it together, and you saw them sitting up in it together. Right. And that seemed a thing.
And there was often the suggestion that they were, I don't know, having
was
fun.
There?
Sometimes.
I don't remember that at all.
Oh, yeah, no, sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I certainly know that on Happy Days, the Cunninghams would talk about getting frisky.
Getting frisky.
Going upstairs to
frisky,
get frisky.
Going upstairs and
we never
frisky.
Saw their bedroom, if I recall. I don't think we did.
Not that I remember.
I mean, I was a kid, but I just imagine them just chasing each other around.
On Mad About You, they kind of dealt with the problem of having a sex life plus having a very young kid. And that drove a lot of the plot lines. Switching to American Pie, Stifler's mom, going a slightly different direction.
Right.
With Modern Family, it seems to me that we get a lot more about that from the Phil and Claire couple than we do from the Mitch and Cam.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing.
Or the Jay Gloria.
Yeah. But I mean, really, we get almost nothing of their, like, they do kiss. It's very chaste. It's very sort of safe. So
they could almost, a lot of the time, they could almost be like, roommates.
Friends.
They could almost be like besties a lot of times.
Exactly.
When you bring up people like Rob and Laura Petrie, you know, one of the things about that, it wasn't just parents. It was any married couple. Mm-hmm. I think there was, you know, you couldn't on television, I think, show kind of anyone having a sex life. So even when you had people who were married, I think it was true on I Love Lucy as well.
Yeah.
Even when you had people who were married, they were very skittish about alluding to the fact that married people might be having sex with each other. My recollection is they couldn't say that Lucy was pregnant on I Love Lucy. They had to say she was expecting.
Mm-hmm. Enciente.
I assume because you're just a little too close to when you say pregnant.
Yep.
It somehow has this connection to the sex having and all that stuff.
The sex having, the friskiness.
Yeah, the friskiness. What do you think, Kat?
Racking my brain for all of these different dads and moms who, or dads and different pairings on TV who might be having sex, I really couldn't think of any that really stuck out in the contemporary culture. When I think about, like, Fresh Off the Boat, for example, there's no way that I could imagine them even having the two main characters played by Constance Wu and Randall Park doing it. Because I don't think it would fit into the plot.
But they don't really allude to it very much.
Right, they don't allude to it at all. And I don't know if it's because it's a 90s nostalgic one, or if it's just less edgy than Modern Family. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. And there are a couple of examples from earlier that I was thinking about. I mean, definitely on Roseanne, there was a sense that they had an active sex life and that it was part of what they were always trying to balance with all the other stuff that they had going on.
Yeah. So for the TV shows that do show parents having sex or even allude to it, is it
they
shown?
Don't usually show them having sex.
Yeah, okay. Not
it's
show,
a whole different
not
genre.
Not showing them having sex, but alluding to it. Is it portrayed as sexy or is it portrayed as comedic? Because that's kind of what I want to know.
I think that's a great question. I think that's very often the difference between Howard and Mary and Cunningham, where it was almost always like a silly, funny thing about getting frisky. And then somebody like Dan and Roseanne on Roseanne, where there would be jokes in the sense that a lot of times they did scenes with the two of them getting ready for bed where he would sort of almost kind of kiddingly but not be like, oh, baby, I'm coming to get you. And they would do those scenes and they were funny, but they were also sexy. It was clear that that was a part of legitimately their romantic relationship. And I can remember an episode of Roseanne where she had a breast reduction. There was a relatively frank sense in that episode that she was concerned about the impact this was going to have on her sex life with her husband and on how he would see her romantically and things like that.
I feel like a lot of what you have now in sitcoms, and Modern Family really jumps out at me for this, you know, as a show that tries to be a little more frank about these things, is a lot of the reason that you're seeing their sex lives more is that it's fodder for these big, broad jokes. It's fodder for jokes where the kid walks in on them as they're making whoopee.
Right.
Sorry, all of my references are from, like, the dating game.
Yep.
Match game.
But that one of the ways that they take advantage of a more permissive culture where they can cover this stuff is that it's a chance to do these big, broad jokes. And, like, what are the jokes? Like, unease about the parents having sex, like Bob's Burgers. Mm-hmm. There's a whole, you know, recurring gag about the unease about parents having sex.
Right.
And even about, like, grandparents having sex. They come back to that kind of as fodder for, like, ew.
Mm-hmm.
It's natural in a culture where it's okay to make jokes about sex on TV that it would come up again and again and again just because it's just such a natural source for jokes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think in dramas, you do get a little more balance. It's a little easier for them, particularly in your kind of prestige sexy dramas.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have definitely, The Americans comes to mind. The Americans is a show where these people are parents and spies, and also have a marriage that's very complicated in a bunch of different ways, and their sex life is one of those ways. Glenn alluded to another thing that I wanted to talk about, which is the Stifler's mom. We seemed to cross a moment where it became cool to kind of talk about sexy parents in an ironic sort of way, which I think the most endearing to me version of that is probably Stacey's Mom, which I have always...
The song by Fountains of Wayne.
The song by Fountains of Wayne, which I've always received as kind of a... almost a send-up of itself in that it's a boy singing about his friend's hot mom. Yeah. And that one seems sort of in good humor because it's so silly.
Well, in part because the protagonist of the song, the singer of the song, is so naive.
Right, so naive and so dumb and kind of believes that, you know, maybe he can, like, hit on this mom. But I think there have been times when that's been a little less endearing, a little less warm.
Sure. But then something happened. I mean, I think a cultural moment happened. It's not quite the cougar thing, although it's related, very closely related. Where it was suddenly okay to find older people slightly attractive in a humorous way. I mean, like, there is a entire Tumblr devoted to hot dads at Disneyland. and if you Google hot dads of Disneyland with Safe Search on, you'll find a lot more of that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
If you take Safe Search out, you will find something entirely different.
Yeah.
Well, yep. I wanna posit a possibly a larger point in terms of who should we thank for this more welcoming view of older people as sexual beings. And I think this is one of the few areas where we can thank baby boomers. I think that I'm as a Generation Xer, I'm quick to blame baby boomers for a lot of things.
Right.
But I think the massive kind of planet-sized self-absorption of baby boomers as a culture has dictated the idea that, like, you can be older and still sexy because you have a whole bunch of people who experience that.
Right.
And I think that has led in a wave of, like, now I'm 42 and, like, of course older people are sexual beings. Of course dads are sexual beings.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think this is one of the few times in which I'm going to say, thank goodness for baby boomers.
This leads us inevitably, and I was hoping we'd avoid it, it leads us inevitably to the idea of dad bods.
Yeah.
I was really hoping we
were talking about
it. It led you. Because
this is what straight middle-aged dudes need to hear right now, at this moment in time, in this culture. You're fine.
You're fine.
Change nothing.
You are an object of desire.
Okay. Yes. If you have not heard this ridiculous dad bod thing, it is this word that is being thrown around to mean that what people now find hot is dads who have, like, a little more pudge and a little more pastiness. And I don't.
Hey, patriarchy, looking good. that's exactly what it is. It's just the dumbest thing.
Oh,
you're yelling out the car window at the patriarchy.
Change nothing. Never.
Stay the same.
Literally never change.
Never change. Well, you know what Stephen was talking about, kind of who to thank for a lot of this. I think there have just been certain characters who over time have really started to get inside people's heads and change kind of some of these perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Kat and I spoke earlier today about a fellow by the name of Kyle Chandler.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
who is on Friday Night Lights and basically was an extremely sexy dad. He would be on any list of sexy dads, in my opinion. And, like, unlike a lot of sexy dads who have been on television or in movies or whatever, one of his primary identifications is as a dad. He's not a sexy person who's incidentally a dad.
Right.
He's sexy partly in that he is a family person.
But I was kind of trying to think about why Kyle Chandler is seen as so sexy. And I mean, it's a family thing, but then also it's because he is so moralistic and he would never do wrong by his family. He would never do wrong by his townspeople or the people who surround him or the people who depend on him.
Right.
Yeah. He's sexy, but virtuous.
Right.
Well, he's sexy with a certain, like, through a certain kind of authority, through a certain kind of moral authority.
Yeah.
That's the thing. The story of that show is, yes, he spends most of his screen time smoldering, but it's actually to express how disappointed he is.
It's the disappointed emotion.
That's the crux between sexy and dad.
You might be projecting just a tiny bit.
But I wonder, would he still be as sexy if he wasn't a father?
If he was happy-go-lucky, he would not be nearly as sexy. If he was just a happy...
Yeah, no, I don't think I would want happy-go-lucky Kyle Chandler. That just sounds so weird to me. I don't know if I could possibly...
No, the furrowed brow is what makes his face.
That's why all his other roles are as cops or government officials of some kind.
Yeah.
I feel like it's weird to talk about Kyle Chandler without talking about Connie Britton and how amazing she she was.
She is.
Where her character is just as sexy and as
I'm sorry, did I say that out loud?
And their relationship is so fraught, where a lot of it is about she sacrifices a lot for him and there's always a negotiation. And I think that in itself, the way they go about being parents together is very romantic, I would say.
That show is extremely romantic. Oh, yeah. I've heard a lot of people talk about that as one of the most successful romantic relationships that television has probably ever portrayed. Yeah. And I would agree with that.
And if you think about it, it makes sense that family sitcoms, which are engineered to be watched with the whole family, would kind of come at an angle at the sexual content.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As opposed to a drama like Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think comedies always have a like weird relationship with that kind of stuff anyway. All right, well, again, I'll be very interested to hear what all of you have to say and what you think about the sexy parents in your own I don't know. I'm just kidding. At any rate, when we come back, we're going to get to our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So don't go away.
Hi, I'm Mary Morrison, and I'm calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. This episode and the following message are made possible by Stamps.com. Stamps.com helps businesses avoid trips to the post office. With Stamps.com, use your own computer and printer to print official U.S. postage for any letter or package, and then the mailman picks it up. No more wasting time going to the post office. Use the promo code POPCULTURE for a special offer. A no-risk trial, plus a digital scale, and free postage. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and type in POPCULTURE. That's Stamps.com. Enter POPCULTURE.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
The theme of this entire episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour has been Stephen Thompson is overserved by the culture.
Yep, there you go.
So it would only make sense that in our C segment, What's Making Me Happy, I would come up with the piece of culture that is most engineered in a lab to appeal to me specifically.
Right.
That is a studio session for AV Undercover. Sort of ping, ping for things that appeal to me is the AV Club, which I founded. AV Undercover, which is a performance series, is not unlike the Tiny Desk concerts, in which they have musicians they love come in and perform covers from a list of songs that they have put together. I think I've talked about this series at some point on the show before.
I'm not sure.
But there's one that they just put up in which the band Sylvan Esso, a band I love.
Uh-huh. Yes, I love them.
Teams up with Jen Wassner from Y-Oak, a band I love,
yep,
and has them perform a song called Everything is Free by a singer I love named Gillian Welch. Mm-hmm. And when the voices of Amelia Meath from Sylvan Esso and Jen Wassner from Y-Oak and Flock of Dimes, when their voices converge at the beginning of this song, it is just absolutely glorious.
Everything is free now, that's what they say. Everything I ever done, gonna give it away. Someone hit the big score, figured it out. They were gonna do it anyway, even if it doesn't pay.
This mashup of musicians I love covering a musician I love for a website I helped create.
Nice.
Me being absolutely massively overserved by the culture.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Two things. The first, anybody who knows me knows of my famous love of, nay, passion for, the dance. ballet is my life. It actually is. And I don't have a particularly strong connection to it. There is a documentary called Ballet 422, which follows a very young 25-year-old dancer in the New York City Ballet who gets the opportunity to choreograph a new ballet, the 422nd new ballet that the New York City Ballet will put on. The filmmaker follows this kid for 2 months. And I think it's important to let people know what they're in for here. It is a very low-key, not particularly dramatic film available for rent on iTunes. It is also, regrettably perhaps, not warts and all. Everybody is being very nice to each other in a way that is sort of approved by the New York City Ballet, I'm sure.
Sure.
And you also get none of the talking heads telling you how important this is for him. It's a very sort of fly-on-the-wall perspective. There's no attempt to explain everything that's going on. It might sound dull, but if you are a process nerd like me, you see this show coming together, and there's none of this sort of artistic, artsy-fartsy, you know, my body is my tool. It's all about the technical aspects of putting a show together. The lighting. We spent a lot of time on the lighting and the costumes and the music and the dancing. It's just it's just fascinating. So that's Ballet 422. The next thing is, brace yourself, a podcast called Mystery Show. The fourth episode just dropped this week. It's hosted by Starley Kine, late of a little scrappy little number called This American Life.
Yeah.
The premise of the show is that she is confronted each week with a mystery. It's a non-lethal mystery. It's kind of a mystery of the mundane world. For example, a kid finds a very ornate, very cool personalized belt buckle on the street, and where did it come from? Another example is, an author who is obsessed with Britney Spears finds a picture of Britney Spears holding her novel. So did Britney Spears actually read her novel? How did she get it? All these questions.
Did she like it?
Did she like it? So it's shoe leather reporting, mm-hmm. and she just kind of takes you through her getting on the phone often or meeting people in person and asking them questions about their lives. It's a kind of a shaggy narrative each time.
Right.
It takes these divergent trails. But she's asking them because she's interested in their lives. She's a public radio person who's interested in their lives. So if you are of a less than charitable mindset, hi. You might be tempted to think of this as the gee, isn't Starley Kine wonderful and charming show, because she leaves all that in of these people just being completely charmed by how cool she is. I don't have a problem with that because I happen to think that Starley Kine is pretty charming and wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So start with the Britney Spears one, then move to the belt buckle one. That is Mystery Show, hosted by Starley Kine.
I totally sign off on that recommendation. That show is the best. All right, Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is a book called Your Face and Mine by an author named Jess Rowe. In the book, there's a main character who goes through immense loss. And in his grief, he's a public radio producer. He decides to move from Boston to Baltimore, his hometown. And when he's there, he comes across an old friend who has been gone for about 20 years. And his old friend he knew as a white Jewish dude, and all of a sudden now he's an African American man. This book is all about the possibilities of what's called racial reassignment surgery, and it's fiction, and it's just beautifully written, and Jess Rowe has this eye for detail about so many different things. He can write so expressively about grief and loss, just as he can about the main character living in China, and just as he can about transgender and then also racial identities being so fluid, if you will. That is very thoughtful, and it's helping situate my brain in recent news.
Right,
so
sure.
I really appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Kat Chow. I got two things this week. I wrote this week on the blog about the audiobook of Aziz Ansari's new book, Modern Romance, which the book is terrific and the audiobook is particularly terrific. But one of the things that this got me doing was watching a bunch of old Aziz Ansari specials. And I kept fixating on this one passage from this 2013 special called Buried Alive, in which he's doing kind of crowd work. And he starts asking this guy, how did you propose to the woman that you're now either married to or engaged to, I think married, how did you propose? And the guy starts to say, oh, it's a five-star restaurant. And so it's like, okay, five-star restaurant. Okay, so I assume you were there for dinner. Well, actually, it was lunch. And this starts this whole cascade of this story sort of getting smaller and smaller. And it's like, it's not that great of a story, but it becomes an amazing piece of crowd work.
What period of the meal do you decide to ask? Because that's very difficult, you know? You can't ask, like, you know, before you order, because it's like, all right, what? He asked before you ordered? What the hell? Isn't that kind of a scary idea? What, do you want to have the most awkward lunch of all time? No. You want to spit some jalapeno poppers?
So that's Aziz Ansari. His special, Buried Alive, is on Netflix, or you can listen to it on the album as well. The other thing, my actual making me happy this week, new thing, this season on The Real Housewives of New York City, Bethany Frankel has returned to the show, right? And I talked about this, I think, at some point. Mm-hmm. But she is doing a thing this season that has gotten more and more weird in a great way, which is she has decided to come back and act like she doesn't know why other people aren't acting normal. So every time someone tries to bring up some old grudge that no one would care about, she'll sort of say, why are you bringing this up? As if she's not on The Real Housewives of New York City. And this seems to be her strategy. And there is a moment in the most recent episode as we tape this, which I think will be the second to most recent when you hear it, in which this woman basically says, like, I need to have a fight with you. Like, I need to talk to you. Pulls her aside and starts to kind of say, I'm angry about this thing that you said. And they barely know each other. She's just angry. I'm angry. And she's trying to have a Real Housewives fight. And Bethany's like, okay, bye. And she gets up and walks away. And the woman's like, come back here. What are you doing? Get back here. And she's like, oh, no, I'm leaving. And it feels to me like it is some kind of weird Truman Show experimentation thing that she's doing. She still has her own occasional moments. She'll kind of cry and get emotional. But there are these moments where she seems to have decided to unravel the show in this way that is so much more interesting than the show, because you can see these other women sometimes. She does not appear to be doing what she's supposed to be doing. How are we going to stand here and have this fight?
I can't work with this.
I can't work with it. She'll just be like, oh, no, I don't care about this. She has told people probably 15 times this season, I don't want to talk about this. I don't care about this. Oh, this is so boring to me. Yep. It's some kind of weird theater that she's doing, and I am so into it. I can't even tell you. It's making me very, very happy. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Kat at Kat Chow. That's K-A-T-C-H-O-W. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Jessica is helped this week by Kiana Fitzgerald, who you can follow at Kiana Fitz. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? Well, he kind of does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.